Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. In today's episode, I invite three special guests to discuss a new book by educator and anthropologist of education, Laurie Hammond. Growing Whole Children in the Garden is at first glance a book addressed to parents, filled with activities to enrich children's experience of the outdoors. But hidden within its pages lies an epistemology, a philosophy of knowledge based on direct experience of the natural world, and a recognition that the way children learn through lived experience is also the way we can learn to reconnect with the here and now. This episode is longer than some of my other ones, but I found there wasn't much in the discussion that didn't warrant being kept in. As usual, for the relevant links, please go to my website, in-the-weeds.net. Here we go. Welcome, everybody. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day. This is unusual. I usually have one guest at a time. So because there are four of us, I'd like to start with an introduction. So I have three guests today. Our first guest is Laurie Hammond, author of Growing Whole Children in the Garden, which is the book we'll be discussing today. She's the founder of Peregrine School in Davis, California, a progressive private school that's inspired by the Reggio Emilia schools in Italy, as well as other progressive educators. She has a PhD from UC Davis in sociocultural studies and has been involved in education, largely in public schools, for 50 years, so has quite a bit of experience in education. Also here is Margaret Abels, a comedian and writer whose work has appeared on MTV, Comedy Central, and Steve Harvey. She is the co-host of the comedic parenting podcast, What Fresh Hell? Laughing in the Face of Motherhood, which has helped many of us mothers get through the pandemic. And also my good friend Sonia Fujimori, who has a master's degree in early childhood and elementary education from Bank Street College of Education in New York City, who taught first grade for many years and also coordinated the Edible Garden program for her children's elementary school, which also happens to be Meg's and my children's elementary school. Sonia's and my children are now graduated. They've now moved on. And Sonia and I work together at the Edible Garden to develop a pollinator curriculum for kindergarten through fourth grade. So, Laurie, as you are our principal guest here, I want to start with a question for you. We're going to be focused on your book, which we've all read and enjoyed. But I'd like to talk to you a little bit about your background, because you bring a lot of experience to this. Could you just tell us a little bit? I mean, I know there are many chapters, there are many stories to tell, but tell us a little bit about your trajectory as an educator.
Well, I began in sort of Berkeley in the 60s, and I was one of the free speech movement people, et cetera, and involved in the civil rights movement and anti-war. And so I went into education initially as a kind of political statement of, you know, how can we create more equity using the education system? And so I started working in Berkeley and Oakland, mostly with African-American kids. But then very quickly, we began to realize that we were so involved in all this political change, but really out of touch with even our own bodies, let alone the earth around us. We were all eating junk food and staying up all night and talking about things, and it didn't seem in sync. And so my past husband and I, decided to come up to Davis and study ecology, and we got a small farm and started growing organic apricots. So I became involved from that end in the whole idea of how to get more integrated with the earth. And then that from the beginning came to seem like what should happen with kids. So I started a small preschool, because at the time that we came up to the small town of Winters, which was a farm town, there was no preschool for kids there. So I started the Winters Parent Nursery School in the little farm town of Winters, because at that time, my children were young and there was no preschool there. And I had come from teaching experience in the Bay Area, so it seemed like an obvious thing to do. And that catapulted me into bilingual education, because Winters was a different kind of community. And I was thinking, what do I do now that I'm here? Because I had been so involved in civil rights, and I became involved kind of in the farm worker stuff and in creating a bilingual preschool. So that was one era. But what I did really learn from the experience in Winters was what it was to live in a town where everybody was centered around land and agriculture. Because although Winters was quite a class hierarchy place, which had a lot of issues with. At the same time, everybody, whether they were the farm owner or the farm worker, was involved with the same agricultural crops at different seasons. And schools even stopped the day that the apricots got ripe. So it was a very, you know, a town unified around land. And so that naturally became the basis of our curriculum at the preschool. And that kind of started something that I kept on with for probably the rest of my career. Because my work at Berkeley had shown me you should always build on what the community values. But it turned out that in that community, that was land and agriculture.
That's so interesting. I'd like to hear more about the rest of your career, but just picking up on that, that connects in two ways to your book. One is your emphasis on seasons. So the whole book is organized around seasons, which you experience differently being in a Mediterranean climate than we do on the East Coast. So can you talk a little bit about your decision to organize it around the seasons?
Yes. You know, when you start, as you know, probably when you start on a writing project, you're not quite sure how you're going to organize it. And I thought of all different things, teachery things like around science or art. And then the seasons seemed like the center of the thing. The interesting thing to me about seasons is that at first I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to write like a Hallmark book or something. I didn't want it to seem like it was trivialized by being seasons, you know, kind of like now it's time to get out the pumpkin folder or something because it's October. Because teachers often, you know, there can be very trivial ways to deal with season. But I also realized that season is something that universalizes the experience of people in a place. That's really what it is, because the season, you know, obviously determines if we're paying attention, what we eat, and it determines, therefore, you know, kind of what the traditions become for the holidays of that time. And I came to realize that, you know, the seasons are actually a really profound thing. So that even though now I live in a suburban house with a pretty big garden, but not a farm anymore, I feel like it's necessary to commemorate each month, like plant potatoes in February, even if I'm not making enough potatoes to, you know, eat all year or anything like that. It just puts you in sync with what's going on the earth at that time. So then the seasons came to seem like the right way to organize it.
Meg, that's something you guys have been dealing with on your podcast as well, right? With the book Wintering and so on.
Yeah, we had an author named Catherine May on our podcast, and she wrote a beautiful book called Wintering, and it's about the season of winter, but it's about her basic philosophy is that it's a parallel for winters of the soul and winters of our lives, and the idea that everybody winters at some point. Everybody has to turn inward and burrow, and that her philosophy is that we think that life points towards summer, that our lives are really about harvest and joyfulness and seasons in the sun, but that in the natural world, all life points towards winter, towards getting ready for what is going to come. And it's like you said, seasons can be a very facile way to, you know, bad poetry explain stuff. But I found this book, it changed my whole perspective on winter and on this whole idea that seasons of life doesn't just mean we're always waiting for summer to come.
I feel like that's particularly profound given what we're going through this winter with the pandemic, right?
Well, she made a joke that she said, I actually wrote this. I did not cause the pandemic by writing this book, but I did. It went from, I think, probably a, you know, a book that maybe would have appealed to some people to this kind of runaway bestseller just because everyone needs to know how to deal with winter all of a sudden.
Yes.
A winter that goes on for a year and a half.
Yeah, absolutely.
I just wanted to jump in from a cultural perspective. I think I mentioned this to Nicole that my father is Japanese. I've had the opportunity to spend some time in Japan with my relatives and family. And something that when I come back to the US that I always feel like I'm missing is that connection to the seasons, which is really strong in Japan. And you know, there are certain flowers that are identified and there's a place in a house that called a tokonoma, which is alcove where you put a vase, and in that vase, you know, whatever season it is, it's in your entryway, you put the corresponding flowers, and it's sort of, you know, this symbolic gesture of honoring that season. And you know, the, like you spoke about, foods that are selling to the seasons, and it's definitely this like shared cultural experience, which I found so grounding. And when I would come home to the US, it was sort of like I felt adrift And I feel like that's something that, you know, American larger culture, whatever, you know, we are at a loss, you know, without that. And so I really appreciated that as a way to organize your book.
Oh, good.
So it also speaks to the connection to place, right, which is such an important part of your book. And it's something that I've thought about a lot, too, in my work on this podcast. Sometimes it's hard to articulate exactly why that's important. Can you talk about that a little bit, like why you think place is important, specifically in working with children?
Yes. Well, for one thing, I think we now live in a time where everybody's on media all the time, right? And so it's so easy to imagine that your place is kind of either the whole world or some kind of fantasy reality that doesn't have any rules at all. And I feel as if now more than ever, it's really important, and especially during the pandemic when everybody's online all the time, to go outside and see what's actually there. In terms of young children, I think it's always most important to focus on and teach kids from whatever they actually experience. And the easiest way to experience things is to experience the place where you are and what's happening in it at that time of year, what's there to eat, all those different aspects. And but I think that place-based education is very profound from a broader point of view for any age, because of the fact that if you really understand the workings of a place, you can understand the workings of any place, because all ecosystems basically have the same elements. And so it seems like if you don't understand the workings of your place, if you're, you know, trying to save the rainforest when you live in upstate New York or whatever, you're not really getting a very deep understanding of what's going on. And so that's why there are just a lot of reasons why place-based education works. But it particularly works to create relevance in kids' lives. And I think education so often isn't relevant. It often comes out of a textbook and is universalized, which was actually seen as an ideal. And that's an ideal I kind of disagree with.
Yeah, I have to say, I found that aspect of the philosophy that really underlies your book really moving. You know, you point out that education often goes from the abstract, from the conceptual to the particular, and that's not a way of thinking that really makes sense for children. And honestly, I think it doesn't make sense for adults either. It's just that we've kind of acclimated to it more. So, you know, just to cite one example, my last podcast was on geology, interviewing this geologist, and I was trying to sort of remember, like, what did I learn about rocks when I was a kid? Or like, probably not that much, but the examples that I could come up with were things like those rock kits, you know, where you have all these cool rocks in a set, or you learn the general categories. But none of that really allows you to understand where you are or why this is important or why this is interesting.
I was going to pick up on what you said about this applies to moms as well, because I think being in your place is a gift that the pandemic has given to us in a certain way, that I know it has completely changed my point of view about summer is for packing up a big bag of stuff and going to the pool, and then you've got to bring the snacks and then this. And we have engaged in a year-long exercise in existing in our place without a lot of other stuff to do. So digging in the yard is what we do, and running around and seeing if you can walk across that long log without falling off, and taking away the structures that have in some ways inhibited us from seeing where we are has been a really lovely exercise in its own way. And I see where educationally that's really valuable for kids. And I see for myself, we have a running joke on our podcast because we talk a lot about friluftsliven, the idea, the Nordic idea that you spend a lot of time outside, no matter the weather, because the outdoors is just beneficial in every way. And that we have tended to see winter as like something to be run through quickly on the way to the warm car and then run through quickly on the way home. And that we have almost jokingly adopted this like very aggressive friluftsliven lifestyle where I'm putting on a snowsuit and sitting outside and reading a book for 2 hours a day. That's not something I was going to do before the pandemic, but this acceptance of place that this has brought me is, I find it a gift, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I mean, it's funny that as animals, as human animals, that like one of the things that we struggle with the most is just seeing where we are in the moment. it's a strange kind of evolutionary trait.
And I definitely grew up in a non-outdoorsy family. My parents had both grown up in the Bronx and Brooklyn, and I married a Texan, and my sisters-in-law on my husband's side are both like nature girls. And I always have this joke with them where I'm like, I don't really like the nature to touch me. I like to see it, but you know, they want to go out and hang in the creek and the fish are swimming up your pants, and it's not for me. But I think that my perspective and growing up, my parents' perspective was kind of nature was something to be like paved over and then looked at from the asphalt. And it is a journey for me to sort of get out of that mindset and be a little bit more interactive.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's turn to the book a little bit. So, you know, the garden is kind of the organizing principle in a way, but you define the garden very broadly, which is one of the things that I really liked as well. Mm-hmm. You know, it can be a traditional garden, like a vegetable garden, but it can be, you know, the area around a street tree or an abandoned lot or something like that. So tell us about how you understand this notion of garden, Lori.
Well, one of the things that I really wanted to avoid in this book was the notion that this is a situation for privileged people that have big yards. Obviously, a lot of us are really lucky in this pandemic if we have really nice places to go outside right out of our door. Other people don't have that. But virtually everybody has access to some kind of park or natural area, or as you say, even a street tree where there are some ants walking around or something. And it seems really important that we move, especially as we're trying to learn how to survive on this planet better, that we move our notion of environmentalism or nature study or something from the domain of the privileged and understand that this can happen in all kinds of settings. And I happen to have a lot of experiences making urban gardens with refugee families in urban schools and seeing the profundity of working with them and what they knew. They knew so much more about it than any of us. But it's also important to understand that this can happen and that we need to advocate for those kind of opportunities for people who do live in places that are not so privileged. But also the idea just that, you know, even if you're talking about a potted plant outside, you're talking about natural forces that you really can't control. And that's quite different than our inside. And so all of it relates to the bigger picture of what's going on in nature, things like we're saying the seasons and the sun and stuff. Even if you're talking about very small things, they're not in isolation the way a lot of people think of them as being. Mm-hmm. From the bigger picture. And with kids, the important thing is to point out the bigger picture, like, oh, this plant may not be doing well because it's on the wrong side of the house. Let's look at where the sun is at whatever time of the day. And I love it that you mentioned the animals, because when we were early, my ex-husband's a solar architect, and we were trying to design solar houses, we would watch where the dog would sit. Because the dog always knew what was happening at each time of the day, where it was warmest, huh. Or in the summer where it was shadiest. And, you know, animals know these things, and people get out of whack where they, you know, say they're too hot, but they don't even move to the shade.
That's funny.
That makes me think of, I love this quote from chapter one of your book, naturalist skills are fundamental and are the birthright of all children and families. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, what you're just saying, I feel like we sort of all lose touch with that and feel not empowered to do those kinds of ways of looking at the world, which we really all can.
And just one little other comment is just that I think it came to us that it was really important to have the poster that goes with the book, which is about the cycle of the seasons. That poster is also in the book if one doesn't have it. But I feel like we introduced calendars to kids again in this totally abstracted way in these 12-month things that are in squares. They don't even correspond to the sun's seasons. And how would you ever figure out what's going on, that this is actually a cycle? it seems like some human controlled thing where we can put the dentist appointment in the squares and have control over the situation. But, you know, it's related to something that this is even happening. And normally you don't look at a calendar and have any idea about that.
Yeah, it's interesting. It makes me think of my daughter who, you know, if I tell her that she has like an upcoming scheduled class online or something like that, she likes to tell people that she doesn't get time. she's just like, but in a way, you know, I mean, I laugh at her, but of course it is very abstract. Maybe it makes me think maybe I should teach her time in relation to the sun, you know, and take her out in the middle of the day and say, this is the middle of the day. This is what it looks like. But going back to what you were saying earlier, you were talking about working with refugees, and I know that you've worked in particular with the Mien community, I believe in your graduate work. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because I think that's fascinating. And I think that's the kind of experience also that really informs what you're writing here.
Yes. I mean, it was an extremely profound experience. I intentionally chose for my graduate work to study a group that did not have a written language. So for them to be transported due to a war suddenly to this urban place and living in an apartment under a freeway and going having their kids go to school, I mean, there was no meaning in what school was because they didn't even read and write.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but we should probably explain because not everybody is familiar with this community. So this is a community that was based in Vietnam in particular, right? Or throughout Southeast Asia and was displaced largely because of the Vietnam War. Is that correct?
Yeah. Basically, the groups that got particularly displaced were living in Laos.
Okay.
And they come, it's a group of people called Hill Tribes, and they come from southern China originally, but they spread out into the mountains of Laos, Vietnam, and Thailand, Burma. But particularly many of them were in Laos. And then there was something that's a whole thing we won't go into, but a crazy secret war in Laos where the U.S. was having a war there, but nobody knew it, including nobody in the U.S. And then the Vietnamese basically won and we pulled out. And these people had been seen as our allies. And so they were targeted and basically would experience genocide if they didn't get out of there. So they fled and they got involved in being in a lot of refugee camps, different places, and many ultimately came to the U.S., some to other countries. And so they were uprooted from having had 300 or 400 years where they lived in the mountains, completely subsistence people who made everything for themselves, grew the hemp to make their clothes, embroidered their clothes elaborately, did everything from scratch with what they had. So they are, if you are fascinated by this sort of nature thing, they're like the ultimate experience for me because it was so fascinating to see somebody who really knew how to do all of this that we were trying in a very primitive way ourselves really to do. But they, you know, were so knowledgeable. And that was what was so interesting because the schools considered them unknowledgeable because they didn't speak English and didn't read and write. I considered them the most knowledgeable people I'd ever met because they knew the things I wanted to know. And so we had a very interesting exchange for several years where I kind of did research talking to them and talking back and forth. I taught them the science their kids would learn in school, and they taught me their view of the same thing, which was always that they knew more about it, but from a different angle, even though their language had no word for science in it. So it was a fascinating exchange. And I ultimately went back to Thailand with them and explored them, you know, doing it as they would have done there. And seeing how extremely, what it really pointed out was how extremely displaced from nature we are as modern people, because it was such a journey to go back and back and back to, you know, we went first to the city and then to the countryside and then finally way out in the mountains where they lived. And they would show us how you could find everything you needed to survive. And that was something certainly modern people don't know. But in the process, you also get an appreciation for how nature works. I mean, just one example is that they, you know, we have such a hierarchy that it's so hard to get away from in the modern world that humans are the center of everything. And that's our biggest problem right now because we're actually an overpopulated species at the moment that thinks we're the only species. And they believe that plants are the smartest because plants are the only ones that can make food. Nothing can survive without them. So they consider plants the oldest and smartest, and they consult plants through the I Ching and stuff when they want to know an answer to something because they think the plants have much more perspective. And I thought that was really fascinating.
That reminds me of the indigenous author Robin Wall Kimmerer, who's a moss scientist. She writes about sort of her envy for plants because of their ability to do photosynthesis. That's interesting. Well, thanks for talking about that. It's fascinating. So it seems like you often involve the parents in your approach to education. Makes me kind of go back to what we were talking about before, about how, you know, we think some of the work we're doing is for kids. Sometimes some of the educating process is as much for the parents as it is for the kids.
Absolutely. And I love it that you guys are all involved with parents in these different podcasts and things, because I realized, you know, when I was going to write this book, at first I thought it would be an obvious thing for me to do to write a book for teachers because I have been a teacher a long time. But then I thought, well, really, the audience is parents, for one thing, because we were starting into the pandemic. And I thought, my gosh, everybody needs to be doing this. You know, there's so many things we can be doing at home. But bigger than that, like you say, I mean, the parents are really the teachers of their kids, but also it is in being with kids that we kind of learn how to be again, I think, as parents. Because again, I think the modern world is mostly about displacement. We're always displaced from nature, displaced from our experience, focused on some very small thing while obvious things are happening around us, things like that. And kids make us understand that. Mm-hmm. Kids bring us back to the fact that it's time to eat, or, you know, we're tired now. Why are we doing this? But also in my work in schools, I've always felt that schools should, again, be a reflection of place and community. And so often schools, I've worked in a lot of minority schools, and minority schools are kind of like colonizers. You know, they come in and teach a standard set of knowledge to people who have other knowledge, usually disrespecting that other knowledge or ignoring it. And usually not even aware they're doing that. It's the old colonizer thing. They think they're saving them, frankly. They think they're helping these kids to get informed, and maybe their parents aren't or something. And so I've always taken the opposite point of view, which is called the community funds of knowledge approach, where you begin anything you do in a community by finding out what the community already knows about that. And so like we did an ethnobotany project in a Mexican school community where we'd interview the grandparents and all about what they knew about herbs and plants. And then we grew the garden based on what they knew. And that taught, as you say, the teachers really need to be learners from the community they work with, just as we all need to be learners from children, because children are the ones that are centered on what's really happening. And I think if we can listen to that, that's kind of the basis of the Reggio approach. If you listen to that, you actually are given your direction as a teacher.
I have an interesting question related to that. Nicole, Meg, and I live in a town that is largely white American. And just like the rest of our nation, you know, we're struggling with issues of racism in our schools and, you know, in our community. And I'm working now with a diversity, equity, and inclusion citizen, you know, grassroots commission that came up out of what happened after the murder of George Floyd. And, you know, we're struggling through, like, how can we be helpful to help make change in the schools? And something that I'm wondering your thoughts on are, you know, so like in your school, it sounds like, you know, a lot of the incredible diverse perspectives you offer are actually from the kids in your community or your teachers in the community. How do you think about this in a community that doesn't have a whole lot of diversity? You know, and there certainly are, you know, there are individuals and kids in our community who are diverse, but without having to single them out as being, you know, the people who provide us knowledge or, you know.
Yeah, this is a really weird problem we have because of the way we've all gotten divided up in our society, that people have such limited experiences of each other. You know, when I lived in that little farm town, there were issues with the hierarchies, but I knew people of every class and type and point of view politically. You know, I now live in Davis, which is a university town. I think there's probably not a single Republican here. And it's kind of a weird thing, you know, to have half the country going a different direction and you just have people don't have any understanding of it at all, you know. And that's one kind of diversity. I know you're talking about another kind, but I think they're all related. You know, my studies in graduate school were in anthropology of education, and it always gives me a perspective because I think the key thing is to understand that we are all, you know, we're not like the group that's devoid of culture. We actually are, everybody and every even family and small group has some kind of, you know, culture of its own. And the reason that people are freaked out by people that are different, that they haven't experienced, is because there hasn't been that blending of the cultures, there hasn't been shared experience. And so then people, as almost a natural thing, feel suspicious or worried about something that isn't like them. So as you say, how do you get that diverse experience for kids that are in a bubble of some sort? I mean, the first thing I think is to look for people, like you said, you have a Japanese background, look for people's authentic, they would have to, you know, nominate it themselves, but they need to look for authentic things that they come from that are not mainstream to what they experience now. And it could be poverty. They could be white, but have come from Appalachia, or it could be whatever. But oftentimes that stuff isn't what is on the table when you're in the kind of community you're in. People are trying to fit into that community. And so how do we bring in those things? How do we do like heritage projects where kids write about how they got there and where their grandparents came from, et cetera? And then you build from whatever you can. It really has to be authentic. You can't really sort of bring in the person from somewhere else and say, here they are, you know. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if there's any way to make a meaningful long-term exchange with other situations, like to have a partner school that's in an inner city or something, and have, but it has to be sort of authentic and long-term. And it is challenging, as you say. But I think we have to remember that the elements of culture, like including people, leaving people out, thinking that we do things right, that there are right ways to do things and other people don't do them right. All those things go on in any community. There are people left out in any community. And I think, again, just sort of like place-based education, you think of what are the elements of cultural life that you want kids to learn? And they can learn that in regard to being nice to the kid who doesn't fit in, and transfer that knowledge later to something broader. But
I think that's a very good point. So I find all this social justice thing really interesting, and it's part of what I found so compelling about the book. Perhaps we should turn to some examples. So as Sonia said, part of the richness at Peregrine is that you've brought in some really interesting teachers and they're able to bring their cultural background and their knowledge and experience to bear. So I would love to talk about some examples of things that you suggest. So your book can be read, you know, start to finish, or it can be read in a more as a reference. You know, you can sort of pick it up and pick something out, which I think is part of its charm. So one of the things I liked is that you, I think I mentioned this earlier, there's sort of a range of options from very simple to more elaborate. Sometimes we don't have the wherewithal, or, you know, especially as parents, for something too complex, but you bring our attention to the fact that something as simple as taking a young child and letting them see where the rain goes down the stormwater drain can be a way of teaching them, for instance. So many things that are easy, but that we might not think of. So I don't know if you guys had favorites. Another one that I liked was putting on socks and walking around on socks and then planting the sock. Can you tell us a bit about, I assume that's something you've done. Does that work?
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't work in the sense you're going to get something that you may want as a garden.
No. Here probably you'd get a lot of invasive plants, but I'm just curious.
but it works, you know, in the fall, if you walk through a field that is all full of seeds, which it will be, you're going to get all that stuff stuck in the socks. In fact, we got this idea because everything got stuck in the socks anyway when kids were walking around. So we said, why don't we make use of this? So we got a big adult sock and put it over the shoe so that the kid really gets a lot of stuff stuck in the sock. And then, it's really fun. You just put that in anything like a milk carton or some kind of small planter and water it or put it outside if it's going to rain and see what happens. And you will get stuff growing up. Another thing that's kind of like that are the seed bombs that are really fun to do more for the, you know, in preparation for spring, but to mix together clay and potting soil and a bunch of wildflower seeds and then throw them into fields or vacant lots. And you can feel like you're kind of, it's kind of like an illicit activity, even though it's actually
graffiti, natural graffiti.
Right. It's like the idea of bombing things.
I'd love to back up another step because I find on the podcast we talk, my sister-in-law runs a progressive school in Chicago. Oh. And this is a language that I understand, progressive education, play-based learning, project-based learning. But I have often talked about it on the podcast, and I find I get some feedback like, what does that mean, a progressive school? What is project-based learning? Is it different than what's going on, the kind of education that our kids are getting? I find, Nicole, when you were talking about the calendar and the days, it reminds me of now it's all the new math, right? They're trying to get kids to really understand how numbers work so that I'm always like, carry the one. And my kids are like, we don't carry the one anymore. And it's they're doing new math now, which is whole brain approach to numbers so that you really understand how to manipulate numbers versus just understanding this one structure of how to do things. And I think that hopefully that is a step towards a more progressive education version of let's try to learn in a more holistic way. But can you talk a little bit about progressive education? Because I think it's something that we kind of throw that term around and not everyone understands.
It's a very confusing term because it gets mixed up with progressive politics, right, which sometimes has...
They're like, they're teaching them Marxism and liberalism. They're teaching them to join
it. Exactly. So some people are opposed to it because...
Right. They get scared.
Right. So basically, I mean, if you were to think of education, you could look at kids two ways. And the traditional way, I think, has been that the kid, you know, probably knows nothing and you're going to take the canon. You're going to take all the things there are to know and pour them into their head.
Tabula rasa.
Yeah, right. And so, you know, piece by piece, you'll introduce math or whatever it is, and they'll get it one step a day. And pretty soon they'll have the same thing in their head that we have in our head. The actual understanding that anybody who's in educational or psychological research has is that this is quite crazy because nobody starts with nothing. And we're all constantly sentient beings figuring out the world. And even a baby, that's all they do is figure out the world. They're figuring it out constantly. And so what would really make more sense is to think that the canon, if it has any meaning, is in the world. That the canon isn't in the book, it's in the world. And so what you want to do is just kind of gently organize things so that kids can discover what is actually there. So like, for example, I work in science education and people get all worried about presenting all these standards. But if you really look at what they are, they're things that you could not avoid observing in your daily life if you were paying attention. I mean, that's why they're the standards for elementary kids, is that they come up a lot. If they were very esoteric, they wouldn't be worth having. And so I think that the whole idea of progressive education is that you teach kids from where they are in the context of things that have meaning. And again, it comes back to the same thing, in place and in their culture, which I know, Sonia, you have experience with Bank Street, right? Which I know a whole lot with the culture of the city that the kids are in and how they write their... So everything a kid would do would be more like exploratory and expressive as opposed to responsive, you know, that they wouldn't be so much taught something as that they'd explore something. And then, for example, if you're learning to read, a lot of it would be learning to write about your experience as a way of learning to read. You're always the generator of the knowledge. So that's the central thing.
Another word that, you know, speaks to me or comes out of my experience at Bank Street is constructivism. Mm-hmm. And this idea that kids are constructing their knowledge. Right. By real experiences. So whether it's, you know, in nature, it's very hands-on. In math, it's often, you know, working with manipulatives to build conceptual understanding of math concepts. And then you apply the numbers and the algorithms on top of that. And my experience actually is that I sort of see our school systems, you know, it's sort of a pendulum, right? And I feel like when I went to school, and maybe it was just because I was at Bank Street, but, you know, there was this push towards whole language learning of literacy skills and very constructivist math, which was a reaction, I think, to the more top-down kind of learning. And now I feel like schools have come a little bit more center.
And we're in a funny thing now with this adjustment from COVID, because I was just asked by the county, a friend of mine who's the head of curriculum and instruction for our county, with another person who's from Waldorf School, to give a workshop in how we are teaching during the pandemic using the outside as what, you know, gets focused on instead of just the technology stuff that is how it's presented. And then also how kids can come back to school, because there's so many things they could be doing on school grounds, even if they weren't sitting in the classroom, things that would be safe. Because my school, for example, is operating now and hasn't really stopped because we do everything outside and we do it at a distance so we can work. But I think particularly the progressive notion for parents is, I wish parents could kind of relax, because I think modern parents feel so stressed that their kid has to learn this or learn that. And one of the bad things that's coming out of the pandemic is that it seems like some people are saying, oh my gosh, the kids are behind now. So now they have to be more stressed and more pushed, which is not the right answer. Because I think what we can learn from it, like we've been saying about what you can learn from your backyard or something, is that if parents would just relax and do things around the house, that they could begin to see the connection between those things and the things kids need to learn. Like, you know, it rains, so the worms come out. So then you talk about what do worms do. And pretty soon you're on a journey that can take you almost anywhere, but it starts with something real. And you will find, if you look at the standards that you covered, about half of them. And so instead of starting with, oh my gosh, my kid needs to know this advanced math, and you start by, I wonder how we'd figure out how much dirt we need for this garden bed. And you find out you have to learn, you know, area and volume and all kinds of things. And it's natural to learn it because it's there. So I feel like it's the question of whether you see the kid as the agent in education or the institution as the agent teaching something to somebody. And we, of course, even at our universities, we're very top down. So it's very challenging to actually take a progressive approach. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do it at the university level and people are very refreshed. They say, oh, this is different than my other classes. You know, like I was teaching a class in urban education and I looked around. I used to teach at Sac State, and Sac State is very diverse. And I looked around and, you know, urban education was who was in the class. That's who the undergraduates are there. It's every group. So I said, okay, we're going to study you. You know, we're going to study your background. We're going to study what your experience with education was. They were shocked, and then they were thrilled, because they thought they were just going to have to learn another set of things, which would have been kind of bizarre because the topic was them.
Yeah, it's funny how education can sometimes get in the way. It makes me think of, I like to tell stories about my daughter because she cracks me up. So I used to always get phone calls from the teachers because she wouldn't pay attention in class or she would do something. So when she was in third grade, I got a call from the teacher saying that she would take bathroom breaks, but then she would take a really long time till she came back into class. And he was trying to figure out what it was. And she likes to tell stories when she walks around. So she explained that she would go to the bathroom, and then instead of coming straight back to the class, she would take the longest path she could possibly find through the school to get back to the classroom. And then she paused, and then she said, you know, sometimes it's just hard to get a moment's peace. summed up her whole attitude towards her education at that point.
She couldn't think because she was in school. That's great.
Actually, Nicole, your daughter also makes me think about the loose parts that is in your book. You know, this idea that a collection, a basket of things from nature, you know, is the best toy, all these loose things. And B, you know, I can so remember so many walks with her where she's found, you know, sticks or whatever, and they become, for her, it's this imaginary sort of storytelling wand, right?
Yeah. Loose Parts, by the way, is a great other book. Written by some people here. It's called Loose Parts, and it's really, really interesting. Two community college professors wrote it, and that teach early childhood. And yeah, the whole idea is very simple, but they go into many examples of how you can gather, whether it's recycled junk or, you know, lids on from the top of something, and natural things, of course, and give those to kids in various ways as the toys. Because they, again, it's the inventing from the kid. If a kid has to take some rocks and pebbles and pretend they're making rice and beans, they're putting the ideas onto that, as opposed to somebody giving them a very, you know, wonderful set of toys that already illustrate whatever it might be. There's nothing left for their fantasy. Mm-hmm.
I liked your suggestion. You said that at Peregrine, you collect old picture frames and you sometimes have mm-hmm. them arrange found objects and then photograph them. I always like things that don't require too much labor on the part of the parent. That was one of the things I liked about it. But also the idea, you know, because sometimes the school project, you end up with like macaroni art or whatever it is, and like you treasure it for as long as you have to until you can get rid of it. You know what I mean? So the idea of something that is versatile that can be sort of remade easily, I like that.
Yeah, it's really essential in the Reggio stuff, because for one thing, with really young children, the project of trying to put it together, like to make a sculpture or something, is really the tricky part. And adults often have to do it for them, like wire things together or use super glue or, you know, one of those hot glues or something. Whereas if you just arrange things and then take the picture, you've got the art. And it's so easy. And then, of course, one of my favorites is the Andy Goldsworthy thing where you go out in nature. He's my favorite. And you just arrange whatever you want that doesn't hurt anything, you know, just move the rocks around and the leaves and stuff, and then take a picture of that and go about your business. And then, you know, somebody else finds it, which is fun, or it just goes back where it was from wind and water and stuff. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I think parents feel these days like they have to work so hard. I mean, I think if we just, you know, notice that what the kids want to do is play with the sticks or something, let them do it. And anything you want to teach them, believe me, could be figured out. That's the trick, is for us to apply our education. And that's the trick in progressive education, to realize which concepts that we learned are actually being acted out through the things around us. And that's where the parent gets creative. Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's a perspective that we come to again and again, no matter what we're talking about in parenting, which is this seems hard. Like, wait, this is about making a garden. I don't want one more thing to do. I don't want to make a garden. That sounds horrible. Like, I barely get 5 minutes to myself already. I don't want to play with my kids with sticks. No, you know, that the resistance is that this sounds like another mom chore to me, but that really the book makes it quite clear that this is, it actually makes it easier. It makes it more connected to something. And I think that that, you know, when I first heard about you, the podcast, I was like, oh, they're going to try to teach me to garden. I'm really not interested in this. It's horrible. I need a nap just thinking about it. But what I love about the book is it's a very natural connection. We always say on our podcast, don't do it unless it actually makes your life easier. You're going to read 3,000 books and people have a lot of, you know, they want to tell you that people in France are doing it better. No, no, wait, the Belgians have it all figured out. Like, you could chase every stupid parenting trend, but this isn't really about a parenting trend. This isn't really about, like, to be a really good mom, you have to do a garden now. Right. It's really about reconnecting with something that's very natural and easy.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think one of the words that really popped out for me was the word joy. So you talk about, I don't know if you even name it, but you sort of allude to climate change and some of these big things. And you say, you know, we don't need to scare our kids with these big ideas. We need to start from a place of joy. And I think, again, that applies to the parent too, like, because kids are so sensitive too. You know, if you make a garden because you feel like you have to make a garden because that's the thing that you do for your child, but it's like drudgery for you, it kind of defeats the point. But doing things from a place of joy for yourself and also for the child, that really, it's like this glue, you know, that brings everything together for the child. And I found that very moving also on the nature front, because as an adult, you know, I do feel the anxiety about what's happening in the world. I mean, that's part of what I'm addressing through this podcast, but I don't want to burden my kids with that. On the other hand, I think about, you know, how I can prepare them for the future. So this idea that what we need to do is impart that sense of joy and connection to nature feels really right on to me.
I'm so glad you got that. I think that's central. And I think it's broader. It's to nature and to children. I mean, like you're saying, Meg, I mean, you know, we want to do things with our kids that are fun for us too. Why would they want to do something that we're not thinking is fun? I mean, it's just terrible for everybody. And this is the joyful moments, like when you were saying, Nicole, about knowing the times of the day. One of the things that happened at our school is that we noticed that we had a prism hanging and that it moved around where the light was, moved around on the floor as it will during the day with the sun, you know. And so then we started tracing on the floor where it was landing. Everybody was excited that it was changing. And then why was it changing? So we ended up with this really simple activity where you go outside with chalk on a sidewalk on a kind of day that has shadows, a bright day. And, you know, sometime when you have a day where you aren't running too many places, which is more like during the pandemic, if you go out every hour or two and trace the kid's shadow on the sidewalk, you see the whole sundial of the day. And all kids think that's so much fun to see themselves traced on the sidewalk moving around the day. And it's shocking that it changes so much. You know, people just aren't aware of that. But that's the kind of thing that's so easy. And I agree, we should do the easy things. I mean, there's some things in the book that are more elaborate for those who want to get involved doing indigo tie-dyeing or something. Some people like that, and I think it's fun. But I think, you know, many of the things, the whole idea is just to, you know, notice the worms when it rains and the snails in the spring and stuff like that, that are right there in front of you.
One of the more elaborate ones that I would love to do is the mosaic stepping stones. Can you talk to us a little bit about that one and how you go about it?
Well, they're actually, it sounds like a lot of stuff to gather, but most of this you would use more than once. But it's actually an easy one to get a lot of satisfaction because, like you talk about, we do a lot of art with kids that the parents hang on the refrigerator but can't wait to get rid of again, like you say. And one of the things about this is that it actually, whether or not you're doing a vegetable garden, whatever your yard is like, you can have mosaic stepping stones and they'll last for years and they're actually beautiful. And so the idea is that you just take bender boards, you know, the stuff you can buy that you can twist around without struggling with it too much, and duct tape to make circles of any size you want, really. You can make them different sizes or all the same. And then, I mean, the hard part for a lot of people is the idea of pouring cement. But one of the biggest finds I've found is if you go to any kind of Home Depot type store, there's something that bricklayers use to put their mortar in. And it's like only about $8 for this big black, it's sort of like a rubber sink that isn't, you know, attached to anything. It's like a great big container. And it's a very easy place you can mix up cement, but you can also use that to make like an instant sandbox or pretend water and sand. You can even bring it inside and play with rice in the winter. It's just a big, cheap container. But the idea is that if you mix some cement in there, the kids can actually do it with little trowels and then put it into the stepping stone. And then the fun thing that they really love is you get some goggles and everything. You just save the things that break around your house. If it's like me, there are a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And then they get to take a hammer and chop them up to make mosaics. But it's, again, recycling something that breaks. And if you don't have enough broken things, you can go find cheap things at the dollar store and break them. But the kids love to break them. That's
best part
of the activity. They have to wear goggles so they don't get something flying in their face. And then, you know, you put the cement in the circle and then you just arrange the tiles, whatever they are, broken things, whatever you find in them. And it sets up and you let it sit a couple of days so it's for sure solidly cured. And then you just take off the outside thing and you can keep those rings. You take off the tape, but you can make them again really easily if you want to do this again sometime. But it is a really great thing because, you know, they're always beautiful and they can be moved all around the yard. They can actually be given as a Christmas present to somebody. And they're just a very useful thing. And so we make like 100 every year at the school and lots of kids get to make them. And it's really fun. But everybody from a 2-year-old to a 12-year-old can get into it. You know, the 12-year-old might arrange all the stuff in advance so that they're making a mosaic that they feel in control of. And 2-year-old just sticks things in it, but they both work.
I think I might take that up this summer. Sonia, were there projects? I mean, there's so many. We won't be able to get into too much detail, but are there projects that you wanted to talk about or bring up?
Yeah, we talked about, we didn't talk about the permaculture garden, right? I loved that. This idea that you're just basically, whoops, it's my phone. Sorry. That you're just creating this place where you put leaves and let them compost, and then you toss on your, you know, pumpkin and let it decompose, and you watch and observe, and then you think, well, wait, what do I want to do next? And just it would, that seems so freeing. And I would love to do that with kids in the garden.
That's a really fun one. And, you know, it's kind of in a way defined the original idea of permaculture, which is a part of the sort of rewilding and, you know, stuff you can participate in even publicly where you're putting native plants around creeks and things. But it is really fun. And the one at my school, we have a little one now. The kids love it because, like, they just showed me the other day that they redid the paths in it. And they do whatever they want to do to it. The big rule is you don't dig it up. But you just keep adding compost and stuff, and then you stick things in it and see what grows. There's no failure. And it's completely fascinating to see what happens. It's obviously not completely wild because you decide what to stick in it. But the pumpkin breaking down by itself and then growing again in the spring is a really great one. I don't know for sure if that works in a really cold place, but I don't think the seeds would be hurt by that. I don't know.
I could experiment and see.
I've heard of people having pumpkins grow in their compost heaps and things like that here.
Yes.
And here, a lot of our native plants actually have to overwinter to germinate. So throwing seeds in the fall is a good thing. Part of what I like about that is, you know, I think sometimes people think of gardening as being about control, and it can be a very controlled thing, you know, having your seeds planted just so in nice little neat rows. But, you know, for some of us who are a little bit less good at those kinds of environments, the idea that it doesn't have to be about that, that there are forms of gardening that can be looser and more wild, I think is appealing to some people as well.
Yeah, I agree. And actually, that's one of the reasons, because I like to do things in a very slapdash way that's fun. I can do it with kids, because some people go crazy gardening with kids. Some of my really good gardener friends will say, how do you stand it, you know, to garden with three-year-olds? But you have to let go that if the thing comes up in the wrong place, you say, oh, well, or let's have it be there, you know. Although there are tricks, like one of my favorite tricks is to mix seeds with sand, because then little kids can get them dispersed. Otherwise, all the carrot, the whole package is in one spot.
Yes. And,
so the whole idea is to find easy things to do, not hard things to do. Yeah.
And joyful and perfect, as we know, when we decorate Christmas trees with kids. It's not always the same thing, you know? No. Perfect is too often the enemy of joy, you know? And I think as parents, that acceptance of, like, we're going to go for joyful instead of perfect is a good place to start.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So many parents, do you find, make parents feel so nervous these days? I mean, that's something that I learned from, it's funny, because working with some of the immigrant and refugee communities, I remember having a Mexican mother say to me, that were farm workers, you know, say, why are these American parents seem so nervous when they're with their children? And they're always trying to control what they do and control what happens. And there was a spirit that it was okay in these other communities, that what the kids did naturally was okay.
And but they've done tons of studies about this, but moving from an agricultural parenting society to a non-agricultural parenting society, it changes. You go from, you know, my grandmother was one of 13. She was the last of the 13. She's born in 1901. So her siblings were born in the 1880s, you know, and they had 13 kids because they needed them to work the farm in Ireland. Right. And then I am her grandchild, and my kids, I am told my job is not to have them work for me and help. My job is to fulfill their every need and want through directing their activities. And that's a 100-year switch. And I think that it's almost like you have to find that agricultural connection again to get back to the thing of, we're all helping each other survive, not I am the cruise director of your life. And if you turn out bad, everyone points a finger at me and says, failure right there.
Right. Oh my gosh. And what a pressure on a kid to have to not only do what they want to do, but do what they think you think they want to do. I mean, it just goes on and on. It's
but wow. I see the pandemic as such a gift and a reset in that way of like, there's no travel soccer. There's no SAT prep course. You guys have to figure it out. What are you all, what are the five of you doing together in that house for 1 year straight? Because it's not running around to 600 different activities. So what is it? And I think it's been a gift. I know for our listeners, what's on the other side of boredom? What's on the other side of whining? What's on the other side of some of this stuff? Because it's not as scary as you think. It's kids who now, you know, break more stuff in the house, roughhouse more, probably get hurt a little more often. But I think it's been a lovely opportunity to reconnect a little bit to like, what is free play? Because I think even though we try to talk about free play, that becomes like, I will do free play now. Okay, go. We have 1 hour and do it. You know, that's not what free play is. Free play is 6 hours in.
Yeah.
Like, okay, stop whining and get out of my face. Mm-hmm. And then right. I do find that they're upstairs making a Harry Potter fort and finding stickers. And, you know, my house is a mess. They've wrecked the place, but it feels much more. It feels easier than it did right. before.
Mm-hmm. And getting outdoors, because there really is nothing else for them to do. And if you want to go someplace, okay, it's going out to the woods for a walk or, you know, going for a bike ride, and which was so much. I mean, that's what I did every day of my childhood and my best memories. But my kids never had time to do that, or it wasn't what other kids were doing, right? So that, you know, they wanted to do what their friends were doing, which wasn't going outside to play. Yeah. They're finally doing that.
And if you see the, just as you are willing, Meg, to give up the tidiness of the house so they can play, if you see the garden the same way, that's what we're talking mm-hmm. about, that they can, you know, drag, you know, cloths out there and make tents. And, you know, it doesn't have to be some kind of pruned thing that looks right all the time.
Right. And it's not a toy. That's the thing. It's just being in the space. And right. and that's something that... It's the cruise director lifestyle, which is like, I bought you a geodome. Like, you can make that, actually. You know, I bought you this swing set. And what we find is, you know, those things fall away and then they end up playing like, let's pick up sticks and hit them, you know, hit each other with them.
Right.
Which is apparently an extremely fun game if you're a 12-year-old boy.
Right. That one goes on every day. Yes. Uh-huh. But the great thing about the garden is that it pushes back, that the kids
actually 10:30.
I'm sorry, my computer does that and I don't know why. I'm not in control of technology. I'm not in control of the garden either, but that doesn't bother me. The technology is more problematic because it seems to be in control. You know, if just the idea that they feel that it's their space, they can do things to, and they can cart their toys outside and make fantasy worlds. That's one of my favorites, is the miniature worlds thing. And it's just mm-hmm. so much more magic outside, where you have other props to work with, like leaves and things, than if you're, and flowers and stuff, than if you're just working with blocks and, you know, toys.
And that we haven't mentioned it, but the connection to food too. I mean, I find it fascinating that, you know, my daughter, who I have to pick the basil off of her pizza if she gets a pizza that's too fancy, you know, but she'll stuff any old weed in her face if it's outside and I tell her that she can eat it, you know, like my son loves to eat dandelions. Yeah. And the same with, you know, things that we grow on purpose, tomatoes, whatever it is, like there's something about, it's almost like slightly transgressive, but I think it's also the sense of agency or something of feeding themselves that makes it more alluring than those things might be if they came from the supermarket, you know?
Oh, no question. I mean, the kids at our school, that's one thing the parents really like about our school, because we do have a food program and we use stuff from the garden and all, but also they eat things from the garden and they're always amazed that they eat the things they do that they will not eat at home. Yeah, but also the food thing, it's another thing like we were talking about, is it more work? If you're the cruise director, you're also the cruise, you know, restaurateur, right?
And you're the caterer.
Yeah, you're feeding everybody. Whereas if you say, okay, now we need to eat, first of all, we go outside and see what there is to begin with, that could be added to it. But then not only just that, but the idea that the kids would be involved in cooking it too, and in arranging the table and counting the forks and all the rest of it. I mean, why would it be your job as the cruise director to feed everybody? as opposed to them being engaged in that activity themselves. And like you say, when we're all home, we kind of are stuck with that. So that's what we do. And it's kind of great. You can't, it's harder, much more work to go to a restaurant if it's not open. So.
All right. I'm sending my kids over to your house, Lori.
I wish I knew your kids, Nicole. It's sad to me that they're so far away.
Well, thank you so much. Is there anything that anybody wants to add?
I just want to real quick, just pick your brain about technology and the garden. Like, are they just two different paths? And I guess I tell the story about my, you know, the only connection I see is my son who like plays Minecraft and Roblox. And he'll talk, when he was little, he would talk about tweezing sheep because I guess he didn't know the word was shearing. And it took my husband and I the longest time to figure out what the heck he was talking about. But he, I guess in Minecraft, they were shearing sheep. It was one of the jobs. And he'll grow carrots and he'll grow kale or whatever to, you know, survive. But do you see these as two like mutually exclusive paths, this, you know, this tendency towards increasing technology use and virtual, like we have virtual reality headsets, and then this whole like, you know, staying closer to nature as another path, or are there ways that they intersect?
Well, I guess, you know, okay, one thing is that I think it's great that they're simulating those things, that they're interested in them, but I think the example of Minecraft is kind of interesting because there have been various programs that try to simulate growing things and all. And it's, to me, it's the same thing as the book. Like, you know, in the book, there'll be five kinds of leaves, but then you go outside and there are 5,000 kinds of leaves and you can't tell which category they fit in. That the real world has so much more complexity that it's not really, well, it's just richer to do it in the real world, but fine if you reflect in the fantasy. But I would say that at our school, we're not anti-technology. We're not a Waldorf school that doesn't want it at all. We try to, again, do the reversal of the progressive education, put the tool in the kids' hands rather than have them receive it. So we give kids video cameras. And I mean, actually now we have cell phones that seem to do almost everything. But kids go out, and so something interesting is happening with the worm, record it. And it's fine to me if even a little kid's doing that, then play it back to other kids. But don't so much show them the video. I mean, you might show them a video sometimes. I'm not saying you wouldn't do that. That is one of the things we might do. But in general, put the technology in the kids' hands. So we do a lot of movie making. We do a lot of expressive technology, more than receptive technology. And I guess I feel like that's the same as what we're talking about with all these other things, that they're making their own geodome or they're making their own garden as they would see it. And it may not be anything like what we would want to see, but that's okay. They're then expressing what they actually experience in their world. And there's plenty of technology. That's a way to use technology. So I'm not against, you know, moving to that step. By the time our kids are in fifth and sixth grade, they do all their work online so that they can interact about it and stuff. But but that doesn't mean that they don't do the garden physically. We do a lot of simulation. One of the most popular activities at my school that is like the old lemonade stand in people's backyard is that we have a farmer's market that's the kids' stuff. And they make crafts and stuff for it too. They are totally inspired by this. So instead of even the school garden being something where we say, oh, this year the third graders are going to plant carrots, it's like I give them an array of stuff and they have small garden beds that groups have. And this is something you could do at home, and they decide what they're going to plant. And then they sell it at farmer's markets every 2 weeks in front of the school. They absolutely love this.
Right.
And they have to keep track of how much they bought from me and what it cost. And then they can make a profit. And then they decide whether the profit goes back to the school. We kind of reinvent capitalism. What percentage goes back to the school, what percentage doesn't. And this year we invented the nonprofit sector for the kids that prune trees and all. Everybody gets paid in this funny drink with tapioca in it called boba. That everybody likes it.
Oh, yes, yes.
So if you work for the nonprofit, you don't have anything to sell because you worked on the permaculture garden or you pruned the trees, but then you can get a certain amount of bobas for your hours of work. And so we've kind of reinvented capitalism, and but at an entrepreneurial level. But again, I think sustained projects and the technology is useful when it's useful for that. The kids can look up their own stuff at the nursery and order it themselves.
That's really cool. Meg, and do you have anything else you want to add?
No, I think it's such a great perspective. I love the book. And I guess, I mean, we like to ask this on our podcast. For someone who's listening and thinks, this sounds 10 million miles away from where I am. I feel very disconnected. My kids are on screens too much. We live in an apartment. We're far from green space. What simple steps, like a couple of very simple things for someone who's listening and says, this feels like a world away from where I am?
I get what you're saying. Yes. I mean, one thing is to think about, I think something I mentioned in the front, and it could be very, very simple, but is to have an adventure. To go on a magical mystery tour and to say, we're going to, you know, like one day, today we're going to do something different. We're going to, you know, drive to this nature area or whatever. And one possibility is to make the naturalist kit in some form where you, it could be very simple, but you put in a bag the things you might need to be an explorer. And kids usually like tools like that. And if you'd introduce some new tool, like a magnifying glass or binoculars or something, that's going to be a big hit. And, you know, to just have these little adventures. And you can do that from any place. But short of that, I think to just start noticing things, that's the main thing. Mm-hmm. Really, if the kids aren't doing it, it's probably because the adults haven't thought that way either. Like if you're walking back from the bus stop, notice, you know, the differences as the season changes with the trees or, you know, the worms on the sidewalk. Or like Nicole pointed out, I love the one where you look for where the storm drains are. Who can find a storm drain? Kids love to find things like that. And
I love that. I think it's sometimes concepts sound so unapproachable to moms who feel overwhelmed and they feel like, oh, this seems like another project that I don't want to take on. But it's, yeah. I think that's, have an adventure is such a lovely way to think of a starting place. That adventure can be on West 117th Street, one block walk. You know, there's a lot, or it can be finding a patch of woods or going to the park. It can be anywhere. And it doesn't mean buying 10 books and going to Home Depot and buying box gardens. It's just have an adventure and let, right, let your kids explore versus let them be passive receptors to an iPad, which they may do that some part of the day, but just open up your eyes to where can we have an adventure, I think is a great framework. I love that.
Thank you. I love that too. And just to say, you know, it doesn't have to be all nature. It's an attitude. For example, it could be what your math today, we get to have a fun math today. We're going to take a walk around the block and see how many rectangles and triangles and circles we can find on the buildings and who can find the most, you know, things like that. Very simple. That anybody has, everybody has something in their environment. It's a question of opening your eyes to it.
Thanks for listening to our episode. I'm channeling Melvin Bragg today. Coming up, we'll have a series on the forest in literature and film. I'm preparing an intro episode for those of you who would like to read along with the series. In the meantime, if you have a moment, please leave us a positive review in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And tell a friend to listen to In the Weeds. Thanks so much.